All right. Everybody knows by now, yesterday, the Indianapolis Board of School Commissioners named three finalists to succeed Dr. Eugene White. And a lot of people were surprised that the three were African-American males. One, a native of Tulsa, Oklahoma, Millard House. The other, Dr. Louis Farabee. Millard House currently is the chief operating officer for the schools in Charlotte, North Carolina, Mecklenburg County. Dr. Louis Farabee is the chief of staff of the Durham Public Schools down in Durham, North Carolina. And Thomas Darden, Jr., who is a native of Indianapolis, proud graduate of Arsenal Technical High School, started his business career at Detroit Diesel Allison back in the day, moved forward. Had a successful business career, then went to be a venture capitalist, and then decided he wanted to be an educator in education administration, worked for the Philadelphia Public Schools in a turnaround capacity for 3 years, now works at a company called Aspira, a nonprofit trying to set up charter schools in New York. What many of you listening may not know, You know that Indianapolis is the amateur sports capital of the country, and we have a lot of national governing bodies of amateur sports here. But you may not know that we have a body that is a national organization and national experts on educating black children. It's the National Council on Educating Black Children. And we thought, Chris, who better to know who's out here? What are the qualifications or the experiences of these three individuals, one of whom will be the next superintendent of the Indianapolis Public Schools? And so Diana Daniels, the head of the National Council on Educating Black Children, is in the house. And Diana, know everybody. If you black and in a school somewhere in America, Diana might know about you. And so we invited her to come on and talk about, and so the community can kind of have some better insight on who these three gentlemen are. And you'll get to meet them tomorrow down at the Ed Center from 6 to 8 p.m. I'm wondering, is the Ed Center going to be big enough for everybody going to turn out tomorrow? And with that, we welcome Diana Daniels. Diana, welcome.
Thank you, Amos. It's great to be back on your show. Mm-hmm. And I have taken my assignment very seriously.
And you're very serious. First of all, when you saw the names, did you know any of them personally?
I knew no one personally.
Okay.
But after an evening of conversations with people in Charlotte, people in Durham, and in Tulsa, I feel like I do know them. And well, I also talked with Philadelphia people this morning.
All right, we'll just kind of walk the community through. I'll let you start, because we all want to learn about these three.
Well, there are certain attributes and characteristics of a successful urban superintendent.
Okay.
So we use a scale to kind of judge these three by they've had these actual experiences and if they have done any of these things.
Well, first tell the audience, what, in your view, are the qualities to be a successful school superintendent in a major city today?
Well, I took that and I applied it to IPS, because that's where the person's going to be working.
Right.
And one of the things that came loud and clear to me from the voices across this country was that the person would have to restore public confidence in public schools. And that includes IPS, to get the citizens of this city to want to send their kids to. So the person has to be a strong advocate of public school platforms. The person has a powerful commitment to high levels of achievement for all students, regardless of the student's background, along with a strong belief that this can be accomplished in Indianapolis. And that is key, the person's belief system. The person has a strong belief in the value, importance, and intelligence of every child. Every child is able to achieve. And there's evidence that the person has a deep understanding of leading improvement and achievement, and has had extensive experience in doing so in an urban context. That is a key thing for all three of these young men. That number three statement I just read.
Right.
And number four is also very critical, that there's evidence that the person has positive experience working with urban, within urban contexts, in which other institutions, the mayor's office, the Indiana Charter School Office, Ball State Charter School Office, the governor's office, and that he can work with those various entities. It has to be. And does the person have experience in founding or running a charter school?
Okay.
So they need both things.
So you got to know the public, and you got to know the other side.
Charter. You got to know both. Okay. You have to be able to balance
multitask.
Those. Yes, okay. You have to be able to. And the person has to be able to have successful experiences building a positive, productive relationship with the parents and students and communities. Now, that's important, that number five, because a part of that is voice. Mm-hmm. Is the voice of the community going to be heard?
Okay.
And that is critical in urban areas, because all across this country, we're finding that there are cities where the voice of African Americans is not being recognized, not being heard. And so that person is going to need to come to this city and be able to listen to the voices.
All right, let's start with the PhD, Dr. Louis Farabee, the chief of staff of the Durham Public Schools. He's been there 3 years. Before that, he had a number of positions down in Guilford County, North Carolina. What'd you hear about Dr. Farabee?
I heard great things. He's young. He's energetic. Mm-hmm. He's in his early 30s.
Early 30s,
I understand. He has moved up the ladder the way anyone does. He's been a classroom teacher, but only for 4 years. Mm-hmm. He was a principal, moved into central office, and then moved into the roles of associate superintendent and so forth. He has lots of potential. Mm-hmm. But our question about this is, does Indianapolis Public Schools need a trainee? Mm-hmm. When you put a trainee into that job, somebody else is going to run that system. The trainee doesn't know enough to run a complex system.
Or could it be the reverse? Sometimes a young manager gets in, hey, I'm young, I got this position, I got this, I don't need any help, I got this, and then they make the mistakes that youthful managers make.
Right. We don't need any more mistakes. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of years of those.
Right.
I think what we really need is someone that can work in a complex system that is having financial difficulties. Mm-hmm. That in itself is a whole ball of wax there,
right.
Just a financial. That doesn't include being able to balance achievement scores as well as being able to balance the influx of charter schools into that system. So there's lots of complex things there. We weren't sure this young man has had those various types of opportunities yet.
But you didn't hear any negative, sin,
you know,
no sin.
Everyone I spoke with gave him glowing remarks. He's a remarkable young man, and he certainly seems to be on the road in the right track.
All right, let's move on to Millard House. He's been, for a year, the chief operating officer of the Charlotte and Mecklenburg schools. Before that, he spent nearly two decades in Tulsa, Oklahoma, doing all kind of things as an educator down there.
I talk with people in Tulsa, and I talk with some close friends in Oklahoma City that knew the family well.
Right.
This is a well-known family throughout Oklahoma. The father was with the Urban League. Hmm. The father went to Langston. The father was a hallmark of Kappa Alpha Psi. So a lot of things came out of these conversations. This young man has done a variety of things. Now, he's only been in Charlotte for 1 year. Mm-hmm. Before then, he just got there 1 year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke with some friends in Charlotte, and they tell me that he's very he comes to everything that's going on in the city.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a parent meeting, he is there.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to get along with. He's very much light. And as I was talking with my friends on the phone last night, they began to go back and look on the web, and because they did not know he had applied.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a surprise to them. But they gave him a lot of high marks. In Tulsa, he had run a charter school, KIPP, for about 5 years.
KIPP, yeah.
And so that's a plus there because he's had some charter school
experience.
Been
there, done that, got a T-shirt.
Right. He's done this.
Is that unusual to see someone go from a traditional urban school system into a charter and then move up into an administrative role and move up the ladder in a public? Is that becoming now a norm?
People are switching back and forth all the time. Mm-hmm. But the route that he took is a little different. Mm-hmm. He's close, 41 years old. But he also got glowing remarks from both places. Mm-hmm. He has an extensive background. He's also taught law classes.
He's taught law classes?
He's taught law at the University of Oklahoma.
239, okay. 239-1310. They're telling me if I don't take a break, they're going to send me to a charter school. 239-1310. 239-1310 with Diana Daniels. She's the executive director of the National Council on Educating Black Children. Getting her take, we're trying to, put some substance on the three individuals who are the finalists to run the Indianapolis Public Schools. 239-1310. You may have questions about these individuals, or you may start to get a feeling for which one might be the best fit for IPS in Indianapolis. 239-1310. 239-1310 is Afternoons with Amos. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Diana Daniels and ask her about the Indianapolis native that's in the bunch, Thomas Harden Jr. It's Afternoons with Amos after these. The third candidate for superintendent of IPS is an Indianapolis native, graduate of Tech High School, started his career at Allison's back in the late 70s, Thomas Darden Jr. He now works for a company called Aspira, the starting up charter schools in the New York area. He worked for the Philadelphia Public Schools, but for 32 years, he was in business in a variety of capacities, first in engineering and then moving on to venture capital and forming his own successful, from what I understand, venture capital company. Diana Daniels, he's not a traditional educator. That is now legal under Indiana law as of Monday. What'd you hear about him, particularly when he worked in schools in Philadelphia?
He was not there long. Mm-hmm. He worked under Dr. Arlene Ackerman. Mm-hmm. And when she left, he left. She later died about a few months later. Mm-hmm. But what I'm gathering from Philadelphia natives that have been there all their lives is that he was moved around twice under her. Mm-hmm. I couldn't figure out why he was moved twice. Mm-hmm. He seemed to have been over charter schools, mm-hmm. and he made...
Which Philadelphia charter schools under themselves.
Under a superintendent. Right. Theirs is not under a mayor. Mm-hmm. But he's a Broad Scholar, mm-hmm. and a Broad Fellow. And I know that Broad Foundation likes to put their fellows into superintendencies mm-hmm. to implement charter schools, mm-hmm. and especially those EMOs. Mm-hmm. And Aspira is a EMO. Mm-hmm. Which is
what's an EMO? Because somebody might think that's something in the hospital.
No, it's a educational management or, group mm-hmm. or organization. Right. And what it does, it for example, let me give you a good one. In Indiana, there's three people that can actually authorize charters. Right. The mayor's office, which does not charge a fee to authorize. Right. The state charter office, which does charge a fee to authorize. And Ball State, which charges a fee, anywhere from 2 to 3% is charged. In the last, I have a report on Ball State. For the last 10 years, Ball State has made over $11 million mm. off of charging charter schools this fee. But on top of the authorizer's fee, there is also a fee charged by the company that owns the actual.
Just coming in and running the school.
Yeah. Come in and run the school. Mm-hmm. And those fees could be anywhere from 12 to 15%, depending mm-hmm. upon the company. Okay. So when you add it all up, someone could be coming out of that student's $7,000 allocation for the school. You may have a great deal of money coming out. At least 15% is going to other people. That's a concern of mine with a EMO. Not under the mayor's office, because we only have two, and they don't necessarily go out and recruit them.
The other thing is IPS is a $500 million enterprise with thousands of employees. One could say that is a business, even though, you know, the business is educating children.
Right.
From the business side, this is a guy with 32 years business experience, an MBA from Babson College, which is a great small college that teaches people that want to be into finance. From the business side, any obstacles to him?
No, he was, what I understand, he was an outstanding businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll bring that experience to us. And I'm sure he'll work well with the Chamber of Commerce and all the other businesses here in the city. He's a great politician.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'll do well in that area. The question is voice of the people going to be heard?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what all three superintendents, mm-hmm. is voice going to be heard? And
is it as simple as understanding how to speak to the streets as well as the suites, to use the old Jesse Jackson phrase?
You have to have that personality that goes up and down the scale.
Mm-hmm.
That's what keeps you and makes people want to work for you. Not only is it, I would say, not only is it, does he have great business experience, he has good financial experience. He did have some problems,
mm-hmm.
but seems like he's getting back on his feet. The question for Mr. Darden would be, I don't know what his philosophy is in terms of, does he want this to be a portfolio school district?
What's a portfolio school district in your
view? That is a combination of various platforms. There's charter schools, mm-hmm. that are nonprofit, charter schools that are for-profit. There is public schools, there's magnet schools, there's vouchers. It's everything in the portfolio district.
Right.
And that a lot of urban areas are moving toward that. I'm not sure if that's where he's coming from in terms of his job with his current people that he's now working with.
When I looked at the cities that these finalists have worked in,
mm-hmm.
and I look at their school district areas, and I look at the area of the Indianapolis Public Schools, which is the old city limits, the one statistic that really stands out about IPS is the fact that 50% of all children under the age of 18, as of 2011, the last Census American Community Survey data that was available, 50.1% of all children in the IPS district live below the poverty level. None of the other districts that these gentlemen are coming from, Philly is 39.3%, Tulsa 34.2%, Durham 28.9%, Guilford County 23.6%, Charlotte 23.7%. Indianapolis stands out. Is one of the challenges for these three individuals, whoever gets the gig, is understanding that the student base they're working from, half of all of those potential students live in a household that's below the poverty level. And that's that is a stunning statistic that I don't even think the educational reformers really want to understand and deal with.
I think that all three of them can probably handle that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Darden is from here. Mr. House has worked in Tulsa. He's mm-hmm. been in a charter school.
Right.
And he's in Charlotte, where I understand he's very active with parent groups. And Mr. Farabee in Durham also is very active.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that all three of them could probably do that. I don't think that the poverty level is going to have any impact.
Okay.
Poverty should not impact achievement.
Mm-hmm.
That has never been something that Black people have held on to.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been poor at one point in our lives,
okay.
and we've been able to overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
So my question for them would be, are they able to bring the achievement level up, regardless of the poverty level?
Mm-hmm.
Can they bring up the level of learning, especially in reading and in math? What's the school it was called?
Hold on while you think about that. Let me go to the phones and Don. Hi, Don.
Okay.
Don? Don going once, Don going twice. I think Don's phone must have dropped out. At 239-1310.
What I was going to say, Amos, is that effective schools research shows where there are many, many schools with poor children that are achieving at high levels. Mm-hmm. So we don't let poverty get in our way at all.
239-1310. 239-1310 is After News with Amos. Is this a decision where, you know, given the strengths of these individuals, given maybe, I won't say weaknesses, they're not everything we would like them to be. Is there enough for the board to make a decision, or should they punt?
Well, this is the most important decision this board is going to make. So if they don't have all of the right attributes, there's nothing wrong with going back to the drawing board.
I mean, Carmel, you know, got up to the brink. They got finalists, and then I guess when they got them in, none of them really excited them, and they made the decision continue the search.
There's nothing wrong with that. I would much rather see the board take that route than to select someone that is not going to meet the needs of the students.
Let me go back to Don. I think we got him back. Hey, hi, Don.
How you doing, Amos?
Fine.
Hey, I got a question. I'm listening to your guest, and I mean, the three candidates that you guys have described, one seems like they're too young and inexperienced. The other one seems like he may have some financial issues that we definitely need to, you know, take a look at. And then the other one, there may be a personality issue as far as like relating to a school district like IPS. Could they have vetted maybe some other candidates? I mean, these, just listening to the lady, these three candidates wouldn't be three candidates that I would, for a school system like IPS, as large as it is, and with all the difficulties and the problems, it just seems like these three candidates don't fit that picture.
Don, that's an interesting point. I can tell listeners that there were eight semifinalists. There were eight people that were brought in for interviews. We are told that there were 40 applications total, so 32 didn't make the cut to be brought in for interviews. I can tell the listeners that of the eight, six were African American, two were white, seven were male, one was female. Some of the others that were interviewed that did not make the finals were superintendents in other cities. Others had other educational background. And then the only name that was public prior to the finalists was the former Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis. That name was made public over a month ago by the Indianapolis Star, Matt Tully, who really shouldn't have, but he did what he did. That's really all we know.
Well, you know, one other thing that sort of blows me away, you know, we have three African-American males that are, you know, vying for position of superintendent. Why can't we get African-American males in these schools? We don't have a lot of black male teachers. Where did these guys come from?
When you say where do they come from, what do you mean? I think I understand what you mean.
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, you look in these schools and you don't have a lot of African-American male teachers that are going into teachers in the teaching or role models. But these three guys somehow have sort of moved through the system. You would think that they would represent African-American teachers, males, in the system.
That's a good question. And Mr. House and Dr. Farabee all began their educational careers as classroom teachers. Mr. Darden started out in business on the line at Allison's, but let me let Diana Daniels respond to that because that's something that her organization, you know, deals with on a daily basis. That's a great question, Don.
It is. There is a great deal of research and comments and articles regarding the need of African-American males in the classroom. If they're not teachers, they could be aides, they could be counselors, they could be people in there, if it's just a matter of just having a grandfather to sit in there and to talk with young children. So that image is extremely important. I think that perhaps all three of these candidates understand that. I know Mr. House does and Mr. Farabee does. And I'm sure Mr. Darden does understand the importance of that. So I think we just have to put out for all three of these men, there has to be a list of concerns and a list of things that we want to see these men do. Now, I know they have jobs, and after all, taxpayers pay it, but we should let them know. The voice is very important. If you want that to be something you want done in IPS, then you need to let these men know that, and the board know that.
Let me ask a corollary. Thank you, Don. Let me ask a corollary question of African-Americans who are school superintendents. Is it more women than men, more men than women, even Stephen?
I'm going to say, when I go to NAPSE, the National Alliance of Black School Educators, and Mr. Miller House is a member of that organization, and so is Mr. Farabee, there is a lot of men superintendents. There are men. Many of them have retired, but there are men. But there's a lot of females who have come up through the ranks as well.
So it's not the myth of that the male, black male superintendent is a rarity.
No, they're not a rarity. You can find them in Joliet. One of my board members, Dr. Charles Coleman, who is from Muncie, is over there as their superintendent. There's quite a few of them around the country.
Back to the phones in Brenda. Hi there.
Hi, Amy. It's been a long time since I talked to you.
How are you?
Okay.
Okay.
It's the same old when we have these conversations about education, but this is to Ms. Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Daniels, you know who I am.
Sure, I know.
And I've called your office. I've gone on the National Blog Talk Radio, spoken to Eric Cooper. You had the superintendent, Nate Jones, on airway a couple weeks ago. I tried to get in the queue to talk to him. Didn't get on. It appears to be, Ms. Daniels, as I tried to approach your organizations on some systemic issues regarding the maltreatment of black boys in our educational system right here in Indiana, it appears to me that it doesn't matter as to whether or not you have a white educator, or even if you have a black educator and you have black leadership like Superintendent Nate Jones. The issues are, when it comes down to social issues and racial issues, neither the white or the black want to have this discussion about white supremacy in our special education system here in the state or even across the country. So I don't know what difference, you know, will it make getting someone who belongs to these organizations who sit at the top level of education and understand the language that I'm talking, where we're not galvanizing or motivating black people to come around these systemic issues. So I'm really asking the question, what purpose do these individuals serve when they're not opening their mouths about social injustice pertaining to our children of color in these school systems? I don't care what state it's in. You all have a moral obligation to tell the truth, to be honest, tell it like it is, and to say we want more than just words. We want action. That's what we're searching for. And I think you owe it to the parents and our children, Ms. Daniels, to be truthful about the facts that you know. So I will end with that, because, Amos, I haven't called you in a long time, but whenever you have people who come on your show and say these words, but it's empty words, because our children are dying in these cesspools called education, and our people are not speaking up for them. We're not challenging the injustices that are going on inside these school systems, Amos. So I'll leave it with that, and I welcome any comments to this conversation.
All right, I appreciate it. Let me go quickly to Councilman Joe Simpson. Hi, Joe.
Hey. Hey, Amos, how you doing?
I'm fine.
Good. Just got a couple questions. I'm just getting in the car, and could you tell me, or your guests tell me, why are these people leaving their jobs, and why are, you know, if they're leaving under circumstances, or are they just leaving because they just time for them to move, or how well has that done? And the second question is, what organization do they belong to? You know, Big Brothers, Big Sister. It tells me a lot about a person's character when you know that they've been affiliated with some organization and what have they done in those organizations. I'll listen for you.
Hold on, Joker. I'm going to take the second question first. I'm going to let Diana answer the first one. To the discredit of this search process, the search firm elected not to provide to the media a detailed bio of each of these three individuals. You're absolutely right. You raised a good, very good point. Knowing what kinds of organizations these three individuals, Millard House, Dr. Louis Farabee, and Thomas Darden, have been involved in their community, does say something about community involvement, community activities, and what have you. But the search committee, the search firm, did not provide any basic info. All they provided us was the name and where they currently worked. I had to go use all kind of CIA tactics to try to get some basic information about these individuals to share with the community. But some of that other information we do not have, and that is crazy.
Well, Amos, I would say then,
and I'm gonna let Diana speak to your lead point.
Hang on, Amos, before you do that, I want to say then, if that's the case, then there's a real problem with these two candidates. Didn't provide that because
no, it's not. No. Wait, Joe, let me make absolutely clear. It is not the candidate's fault. It is not these three individuals' faults. It is the
either way, the board should know that. People out here want to know the full story, and I think your last person was saying that I'm not talking about untruths or leaving anything out, but that's just basic. That's nothing special. Are they a member of the Ku Klux Klan or something? Are they a member of the Republican Party? I mean, it doesn't matter if they have the character to do the job, and I need to, you know, again, it goes back to my first question, that is, why are they leaving?
Diana, was there any sense you have observed searches like this in the past, and it sounds like these are people that want an opportunity to lead, to have the privilege of leading a school school system?
That's absolutely right. Miller House left Tulsa because his superintendent had announced that he was going to leave in 2013. And the administrators working under him also began to leave. Mm-hmm. So Millard House went into Charlotte. He's only been there for 1 year. I think he wants to be a superintendent. Mm-hmm. As soon as he said he was leaving, his superintendent in Tulsa, the board talked him into staying for one more year, mm-hmm, to rebuild the fact that all of the associates and so forth were all leaving. I think Millard House, Lewis, and Thomas all want to be that job.
So it's not a question of their being run out of town where they are.
No, I don't think so.
I really don't. You know, I understand what you're saying, not about run out of town. We just need to know why they're leaving. That's all. I mean, people understand that people leave for various reasons. I just want to know why they're leaving. Amy, this is what I want to say.
Yeah.
The character of these people, especially when you come to Hoosierville, you're in the middle of Indianapolis, you know what I'm talking about. The character is going to mean everything in the world for this black community.
I think
because people are going to want to know where they came from, what are they about, what organization they belong to, and that's just a pure D fact. That if they get in this job and we find out that this person is like you say, is a white collar hanging up in the Eagle Nest Club or someplace and never down here with us, there's a problem.
Is it normal, Diana Daniels, when you've seen other superintendent searches, for so little information about the finalists to be put out? It seemed like it was just name, rank, not even a serial number.
Well, that was one of the surprises that came to other superintendents I talked to last night. Mm-hmm. They were saying, when is the public meeting?
Yeah.
When is the interviews with the public? And I said, there isn't any. Mm-hmm. And that was very surprising for many of them, because that is a chance to ask those kinds of questions, at least to have some dialogue. So you get a feel for what the person believes. You get a feel for what the person what groups he is going to be active with. You get a feel of the personality. In this case, all we have is just hearsay and no real
and the only public interaction will be tomorrow night, 6 to 8.
Well, Amos, let me say this.
Yeah.
I want that public to know that they need to be out at that meeting. And it sounds to me, even though I won't be able to attend, it sounds like to me they need to go back to the well. You know, because anytime you confirm that don't want to expose just what the lady just got through saying, then they're hiding something. If you're not willing to expose it, there's something wrong. And out here in Hoosierville, if you can't be up front and you can't be honest, I don't care if the search team and every member on that board, if you can't bring it forward, then you need to go. And that's my point, because this is real serious. The Indianapolis system is crashing in. The mayor's going to take over a part of it. We got too many equal parts out here now, not a full part anymore. And it's most important that this person come in here, has the ability to put things back together, at least at 5 PS. And that's all I have to say, and thank you.
All right, appreciate it. The public will not be allowed to ask any questions formally of these candidates tomorrow at the event from 6 to 8. We're told that they will make short statements. They will each be at this event for roughly 30 minutes. We're told that they may be allowed to circulate in the room like it's a reception or a reception at the church or something. We've been told that the media will be allowed to have at them for 20 minutes, and that's all the public gets to see and ask questions. If there's one particular – if people go, if they get a chance, you know, to get to these candidates one-on-one for 20 seconds or 30 seconds, what's the most important question they need to ask?
Well, I think the most important question would be, can they talk about their experiences, mm-hmm. and where have they increased the test scores of youngsters? Can they make academic progress for our children and explain how they're going to do it? Because I'm sure they have studied this system, and they probably at this point have some ideas or some plans in the back of their minds that they can share. Mm-hmm. Another important question on all of this that the caller just brought up is transparency. Mm-hmm. You must be transparent as a public official mm-hmm. with your community. And so one of the questions for the superintendent would be, what is the attitude toward the teachers and the unions? Mm-hmm. We've had so much teacher bashing and union bashing that comes through every publication, whether it's the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Indianapolis Star, Education Week. How is that person going to bring both of those together and work with them as a unit? Because you can't bash teachers. They're the ones who are delivering the instructions to your students. And so I would like to see them have some type of a program or a tenet of how they work with the union as well as with the teachers.
239-1310, 239-1310's afternoon's name is back to the phones and anonymous. Hi there.
Hi, I was wondering, based under the current political climate that we're under, all of the charter schools and what will be left of what is considered IPS, what types of champions do we expect that we could get to apply for the role of superintendent of IPS? And is it no wonder that the folks that have applied may not have the great qualifications that is needed to lead and champion IPS?
That's a good question. Is 40 applicants for a job like this a lot, few, based upon what you know nationally?
That's quite a few.
Okay, because see, I'm from the school of, the fairground's looking for people, there's 1,000 people show up.
So, yeah, that's quite a few.
Okay.
Especially,
but what was the quality of those 40 applicants? Are they the same as the remaining three that are left?
We don't know the quality of the 40. I had some sources where I had some privy to the quality of those of the eight that were interviewed. And so I would say the quality of the eight that were interviewed are similar to the three finalists. There were a couple who were active superintendents. But again, we don't know the quality of the others. And that's
do you agree that you would have to be a champion to take this on based on the political climate or someone seeking a new opportunity?
I think anybody that wants this job has to demonstrate a passion for children, a passion for education, a passion for achievement. And one of the things I'm going to be looking for in meeting these people tomorrow night, I want to hear some passion. I want to hear somebody that can say, hey, will you follow me over this hill? Will you join with the ability to get not only people like me and Diana, but also people like you and Grandma and Aunt Mabel and Uncle Bubba to move forward? They have to be able to inspire.
That's part of what I was hoping that they would give tomorrow is their vision. Knowing the conditions that our system is in, that the city is in, that the laws that have been passed in this state, I would think that they would give some vision of where they wanted to take this district, at least to the public. I think that transparency is very critical, that we know that before the person is actually hired.
All right, good points. Let me go quickly to another anonymous at 239-1310. Hi there.
Yes, I'm calling. I want to make a comment.
Yeah.
The comment is that how are these guys aligned with in politics as far as the Republican or the Democratic Party is concerned?
We don't know.
Well, then that should be an important point that you should know, because as you look at the turnaround schools and you look at the charter school movement in America and the Stand for Children movement in America, you find that the Republicans are pushing this venture. And I think that this is another form of venture capitalism for IPS, where IPS is going to be broken up and sold off as in mercantilism.
All right, that's a good point. On the other side of the coin, I don't think anybody knew what Dr. White's politics were.
We know what his politics was not.
That's a good point, my sister.
And it was not Republicanism because he's not here. So we know that.
An interesting, but good point, my sister. Let me go to Shirley, then we'll take a break at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hello. Diana. This is Shirley Brewer.
Hi, Shirley.
How are you? I wanted to know if the candidates have any endorsement by any of the black national educational groups.
Great. That's a great question.
I don't know, Shirley. I did speak with some NAPC people last night, and they was not aware that Miller House was applying or Lewis Farabee. Many of them did not know Thomas Darden. They did not know him. But they were not aware that these two young men were applying here.
So I don't
know if in their files they submitted a letter of recommendation from NAPC? I don't know. That would be a great question to know if NAPC is going to support them.
Because when we made our greatest gains before in educating young children was that the National Education Associations had endorsement, had agenda of getting black children educated. And I think that's a lot of what we're looking at now. So that's what I'm wondering, were they endorsed by anybody?
I don't know. I don't know if the NEA did or if the AFT did. But I can find out. I'll call them and talk with them.
That would be great.
I appreciate it. 239-1310, 239-1310. It's Afternoons with Amos. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our remaining moments. It's Afternoons with Amos on a very busy Wednesday. 239-1310, 239-1310. People that go to the meeting or see the television coverage, what should they look at in the body language? Because
outreach.
A lot of people that are listening, are the only image they're going to see of these gentlemen are what they see on television, on the news tomorrow night and Friday.
If they touch you, I touch your shoulder or extend their hand, mm-hmm. how open they are, their opening stance, mm-hmm. How they greet you, mm-hmm. you know, the expression on their faces. I think all of these.
Also, how they respond to reporters' questions.
Reporters, yeah. I think all this is very important. There's one question that has come up last night, and the question was, are these three your biggest and brightest superstars in the country? If you're trying to turn around and manage a difficult district's financial issues, then you want your biggest and your best coming
and
in.
And it's got to make, and it's got to close some buildings.
And that, it's got to close. The person has to have done something along these lines. So I don't know if these are the biggest and the baddest and the most qualified in this country, but I can tell you about one young man who was a superintendent in Linwood, California. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's not black. He mm-hmm. is Latino, mm-hmm. Paul Grotto, mm-hmm. and has the highest achieving African-American test scores in California. Mm-hmm. Biggest and baddest, one of the greatest. Mm-hmm. So there are people out there that are doing this work, and I'm not sure that you would want to trade Linwood for Indianapolis. But and Linwood has no charter school, so I don't know.
And when I look at the communities they're from, other than Philadelphia just went through a very serious yes. school contraction, yes. but Darden wasn't in Philadelphia, no. and part of that process to be able to learn from how Philadelphia, and that's a very contentious process in Philadelphia, yeah. these other districts, Durham, Charlotte, and Tulsa are not shrinking school districts. They're growing school districts. So these individuals may not have had the experience of dealing with closing schools, which is coming down the road.
Absolutely. Philadelphia laid off 4,000 teachers about 2 weeks ago.
4,000. 4,000?
They cut teachers' salaries by 13% and their benefits by 13%. And they're closing, I think it was, 32 schools. So that's a difficult district. I mean, that is a lot of managing a lot of different parts of a school district. Buildings being closed, teachers and problems with the AFT, and 4,000 teachers laid off.
Let me ask you one other thing. Last night at the IPS board meeting, the interim superintendent at the board's request prepared a draft school autonomy agreement, where they could give autonomy to individual schools. And this is the first that anybody is hearing about that. And I asked the superintendent, well, if it says autonomy, why don't you just call it a charter? And the interim superintendent did, and she went, well, that's not a charter. That's not the. I said, charter is not a copywritten word. If you're going to give principals an autonomy on running the academics of the school, that looks like a charter, that sounds like a charter, that smells like a charter, why don't they just call it charter and call it a day?
Will they have control of their finances?
The district would still have control of the finances. The district would control. Let me look in here. We'll see. What is the district?
The district, next question.
District would control food, facilities, utilities, human resource support. Budget support is detailed above. Transportation and similar services. But they would work with the person and basically say, here's your budget. You got $3 million to spend. Spend it.
That sounds very much like the Denver plan, mm-hmm. which is a portfolio district where the district does control the food, it controls finances, but you hire your own people, yeah. You call your own shots. It's where a public school district lets the schools themselves have a lot more control.
Does something like that improve the performance of black kids? Because if that system improves the performance, let's look at it. If it doesn't, let's not look at it.
I'm not sure because
it's too new.
It's new, but Indianapolis is listed on the Center to Reinvent Public Schools list mm-hmm. in Seattle, and that is a model that they push. Mm-hmm. But I understand that Indianapolis didn't know they were on that list. So,
well, see, the things you learn on this program, I'm going to give you a copy of this because I can always make, it's like Doritos, I can make more. See, the things we're learning on this show, again, Diana Daniels is with the National Council on Educating Black Children. And their website is ncebc.org, ncebc.org. Thanks very much for being with us. Glad to have you.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the program, 100 Black Men will be here. They got something important. No, not all 100 Black Men. The executive director of the 100 Black Men of Indy. Chris thought all 100 Black Men, it's really more than 100, it's like 150, that they were all going to be here in the studio. But no. Tomorrow, and plenty of time to find out what's on your mind. Oh, and if you want to meet these superintendent candidates for yourself, see them in person 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow, 6 to 8 p.m. tomorrow at the IPS Education Center, Walnut Street between Pennsylvania and Delaware downtown. I'm Amos Brown. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow live at 1.